Welcome to UN Gender Focus. I'm Jocelyn Sambira at United Nations headquarters in New York. Coming up in this week's program, members of the Security Council hear why rape survivors should never again face the prison of stigma. And the 82 schoolgirls recently released from Boko Haram captivity in Nigeria have an uphill road to climb. But first, violence and abuse of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex people, LGBTI, has to stop, including in the workplace, a group of UN workers in Geneva said on Wednesday. UN Globe, the group representing the organization's LGBTI staff, made the appeal on the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. The day is held on May 17 to commemorate the World Health Organization's decision in 1990 to declassify homosexuality as a mental disorder. UN Globe's call has the support of UN Geneva Director General Michael Moeller, as the organization's Gurchatin Sanhu explained to Daniel Johnson.
Often there's a complete silence on sexual and gender identities issues in the UN workplace, if not hostility. The end result is that a lot of LGBTI staff often live in hiding without revealing any details of their lives to other colleagues out of fear of reprisals.
We are in the 21st century and that sounds like something out of the Dark Ages.
Indeed, it is terrible. We encourage workplaces to be diverse and inclusive and respectful. And in particular, in the case of the UN, we should be a model example of an inclusive and respectful workplace. And we should allow for people to bring their whole self and their complete self to the workplace so that they can be as productive and give the best that they can.
And for IDAHOT, which is the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia and Biphobia, do you have any perception of how many people are LGBTI within the UN system? Because without that kind of data, it's very difficult to, A, get any leeway with the senior management, and B, really get an idea about how many people are struggling.
That's a very good question. Right now, we know that we have over 1,000 members as part of UN Globe. Now, that does include LGBTI staff and allies as well. We will be doing a survey coming in the future to find out how many LGBTI staff there are in the system.
So what would you say to people who would suggest that the UN system wasn't set up to deal with issues faced by the LGBTI community, those who face homophobia, transphobia and biphobia?
I think the UN system is the right place to deal with LGBTI issues. Let's take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 1, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. It doesn't say with exception 2. So all human beings. So this does include LGBTI people.
One of the things you're trying to do, I see, is talk to senior management. And indeed, there's a training day at the Palais des Nations with senior management. And the point is, you have the support of United Nations Office at Geneva, Director General Michael Moeller.
What we're doing for the first time here in Geneva is conducting a training for senior leaders on including LGBTI people in the UN workplace. This is a first step to engaging our senior leaders in dialogue and discussions on sexual orientation, gender identity and gender expression.
What happens to some of your members at UN Globe who are posted to field stations where there's no sympathy at all for the LGBTI community?
We do need to work on improving inclusive workplaces for all staff, in particular in duty stations away from headquarters. We need to ensure the equality of an opportunity for all LGBTI staff, that they are able to make informed decisions about serving in countries where there are known incidences of homophobia and transphobia, serving in countries where their partners will not be able to get visas because same-sex activity is criminalized in that country.
So it's as basic as not being able to have your partner follow you to that duty station.
Exactly. It is very much so that you're not able to take your partner, and therefore, consequently, what happens is that duty station, what is recognised as a family duty station, no longer becomes a family duty station for that one person. So we're asking the discussions to move away from a heteronormative perspective and to become a dialogue which is more inclusive and takes into account LGBTI people and has a broader angle of diversity and inclusion.
Survivors of rape or sexual slavery should never again face the prison of stigma, described by some of them as a living death, the acting UN Special Envoy on Sexual Violence and Conflict has said. Adama Dieng, who's also the Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, made the appeal to members of the Security Council during an open debate on sexual violence and conflict as a tactic of war and terrorism. The UN Secretary General's latest report on the topic found that terrorist and extremist groups have been raping, enslaving, and selling women and girls to generate revenue, attract new recruits, and terrorize populations into compliance. They've also been using sexual violence as a tactic to destroy existing family and community structures, as well as to dominate, control, and transmit their ideology to a new generation. Under Secretary General Adama Dieng, who is also in charge of the Office of the Special Representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence and Conflict, reminded the Security Council that behind every number presented in the report was a story, a name, and a face.
Nasima, an Iraqi girl who was so afraid of being killed by her own relatives upon returning from ISIL captivity that she attempted suicide by eating rat poison. Or Sadia, who was kidnapped by Boko Haram and became pregnant as a result of rape. When she was released, local militia from her own community said they would return to kill her Boko Haram baby as soon as it was born.
Sexual violence can turn victims into social outcasts, Mr. Dieng stressed. It can fracture families and corrode the structures that bind communities. Fear and stigma prevent the majority of survivors from ever coming forward, he said.
Simply stated, stigma kills. Many women, girls, men and boys survive the ordeal of rape, but not its social repercussions.
Meanwhile, Amina Mohammed, the UN Deputy Secretary General, said there's a need to redirect the stigma of sexual violence from the victim to the perpetrator.
We see greater national ownership, leadership and responsibility. More governments are formally committing to take action. Regional organizations are working in concert with the United Nations to add to this effort. This is all much needed good news. However, the truth is that we must confront what is the deep roots of conflict-related sexual violence that lie in fundamental inequality and discrimination against women in all contexts. Too many women live with the specter of violence in their daily lives, in their household and families. Armed conflict only serves to exacerbate these prevailing conditions.
All our words and laws and resolutions will mean absolutely nothing, Ms. Mohammed said, if violations go unpunished. The 82 girls from Chibok, Nigeria, recently released by the Boko Haram terrorist group, have an uphill road to climb to get back into society, a UN expert has warned. Urmila Bula, the special rapporteur on contemporary forms of slavery, expressed deep concern about the plight of the 115 girls who remain in captivity. In 2014, close to 300 schoolgirls were kidnapped in northeast Nigeria, where government forces have been battling a Boko Haram insurgency for the past 6 years. The UN has called for continued global support for the country's efforts to release, rehabilitate, and reintegrate all of Boko Haram victims, even as those who regain their freedom struggle to regain their lives. Liz Gafidi spoke to Ms. Bula by phone from South Africa, in which she spoke about the state of the newly released schoolgirls.
No one has been allowed access to the girls, as I understand from reports we've received. They're being kept in a safe facility under the care of the government.
Did you speak to any of the families?
Yes, when we conducted the mission in January 2016, we went to a number of camps in Borno State in the northeast, where we met with a number of girls who had been abducted, not any of the Chibok girls, a number of whom had children, had babies as a result of the abduction. We also met with a number of parents, the Chibok families, up to about 2,000 girls have been abducted.
How are these girls received by their communities once they are released?
The people we met with in some of the camps also said to us that there are big challenges with the girls being reintegrated into their families and communities, because of the stigma and the discrimination and the marginalization that they face. At the time of our mission, two girls had been arrested for planning to be suicide bombers. Since then, there's been an increase in the number of girls being used as suicide bombers.
You've been listening to UN Gender Focus from the United Nations in New York. You can follow more of our programs at radio.un.org. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jocelyn Sambira.